You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Credo Mobile. With Credo, your voice reflects your values. Check out credomobile.com/majority for details.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, December 24th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ho, 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 ladies and gentlemen. In fact, this is the only part that we're doing live to tape because we have now entered the period of our best ofs, 2012. And for those of you who love Chris Hayes, we have a special Christmas present for you. Chris Hayes is going to come to your house. Well, actually, no. That's sorry. We couldn't swing that. Apparently, he's too busy to come to all of your houses. Instead, what we've do, we're going to provide for you two interviews that I did with Chris Hayes this year, two of the several that I did with Chris Hayes this year. Of course, he is the author of The Twilight of the Elites and host of my favorite television program on television, Up With Chris, at least news program. I mean, actually, this year, for the most part, I don't know, I think the Homeland thing, terribly overrated, but it's a different genre. Let's not get into that. We have two interviews with Chris Hayes. The first one you'll hear is from April 17th, 2012. The second will be from June 21st, 2012. And as a special Christmas bonus, because I know you're hanging out, if you're like me and you've had to visit your in-laws, and it's all, you're dealing with intense feelings of alienation. You've probably been drinking significantly by this point. And you're partially inebriated. You're coming in and out of your senses anyways. So I don't want you to get confused. But because we are, we'll be doing best ofs, what we're going to do for this week is to give you best ofs from all sorts of things. Phone calls that we've gotten from libertarians, from conservatives, some people who actually are lefties as well, may they disagree with me. Other brief monologues that I've done over the course of the year, a hodgepodge, if you will. However, today we have a special best of, and it's not from 2012. It's not even from this decade. Well, it's been the past 10 years. But
it's not even from the Majority Report.
It's not even from the Majority Report. It is my one of my favorite... one of my favorite appearances on television that I did back in 2005 when I was invited on CNN to discuss the war on Christmas. And what better day to do that than the day before Christmas? I was paired up with a guy named the head of the Concerned Women for America, a man named Bob Knight. And unfortunately for Bob, his microphone went out at the beginning of the interview. So I was given the opportunity to speak first, and then it all went downhill for Bob Knight after that. So enjoy my time on CNN arguing about the war on Christmas, and then a hodgepodge throughout the week. I don't even know what it's going to be. It's like a potluck audio fest, if you will. Is that okay? Fair enough. So, folks, enjoy today's Chris Hayes interviews. The rest of the week, we got great stuff. Guy Lawson from Rolling Stone, his book Octopus, considered one of the best of the year by the Financial Times. We've got the interviews with the NSA whistleblowers. We've got interviews with a senator, with Derek Jensen, and Michael Mann, Corey Robin, Richard Wolf. We got more and more. I know you're going to love it. We will be back after this. It is a pleasure to welcome to this program Chris Hayes, the host of Up With Chris mornings, Saturday and Sunday mornings on MSNBC, author of the much anticipated Twilight of the Elites, which comes out in June, but you can pre-order, and I suggest you do that right now, because I imagine they're going to have to go to a second printing probably within days upon its release.
That's extremely kind of you, Sam. I hope your enthusiasm is broadly shared.
It certainly is by everybody who's listening, because I've been talking about this book coming out for quite some time, and I'm very excited about it. And what more appropriate day for you to come on and to just, you know, I wanted to bring you on now so I get two bites at this apple when the book comes out. But when Atreos has announced his Wanker of the Decade just moments ago. And of course, it's very much about the elites, and it's very much about how they've twilighted and let us down.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because Atreos's blog has, I think, shaped a lot of the way I started to first think about this, because he has been so dogged in documenting, tracking, poking fun of, ridiculing, excoriating elites and elite failure. And he's someone, and I think what's so interesting and people don't know about Atreus, you know, his real name is Duncan Black, and he's got a PhD in economics. And he is someone that I think, like a lot of people, had the radicalizing experience over the past decade in which they had been conditioned by the institutions that formed them. You know, I think, I'm pretty sure Duncan got his PhD from Brown University, actually, where I went to undergrad, to basically trust in the people who had ascended to the heights of the meritocratic pyramid and had the experience over the past decade of having that trust and faith repaid with betrayal, disaster, and calamity. And it's a radicalizing experience. And I think Atreos and Digby is another one who I think you had on the program yesterday, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
Heather is someone else, I think, who comes from that. Oh, Paul Krugman is another one. Krugman is, as you know, there's no definition of the word elite that Paul Krugman doesn't fit, right? I mean, the guy is a Nobel Prize winning economist and columnist for the New York Times and a Princeton professor. And yet, what the kind of cri de coeur that has been informing his work for almost the duration of the decade is, I cannot believe that all the people in charge are screwing this up as badly as they are.
Yeah, this is something that you've been writing about for quite some time as well. And it is, I think, you know, it started, I think, you know, the Iraq War, I think, was probably sort of one of the the galvanizing moments. It certainly was, I think, for Atreos. And it was in many respects for me, although I think it'd be coming from a legal background of some respects, the 2000 election decided by the Supreme Court was one of those moments,
right,
for myself, where, again, we saw sort of the And let me quote your article in Time magazine, which was titled also Twilight of the Elites. You wrote this back a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, where you talk about the concentration of power, the erosion of transparency and accountability. You talk about the implosion of nearly all sources of American authority. And you talk, you're prescribing and hoping that this new decade, starting in 2010, will be about reforming our institutions to reconstitute a more reliable and democratic form of authority. And then you said something which is also very interesting to me. The scholarly research shows a firm correlation between strong institutions, accountable elites, and a highly functional economies. And a week or two ago, I interviewed Darren Acemoglu.
And I was wondering too. I'm going to have him on too, and I'm glad I now know how to pronounce his name.
Yes.
I don't know about you, Sam. I am terrible about this, even though I am now a professional broadcaster. I always forget to ask for pronouncers, and I have the moment of panic where I'm about to introduce someone, and the name pops up in the prompter, and I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea how to say this name.
You could spell it out phonetically to me, and 90% of the time I will mispronounce it. It's just, it's impossible. But just refer to him as Darren. He appreciates it. But the premise of his book, Why Nations Fail, is because institutions that, the nations don't have institutions that are democratic or
yep.
accountable or broadly inclusive, I think is the term that he
yep.
uses. And it's interesting because how you define broadly inclusive becomes a little bit of a sticking point. You know,
yeah.
In the course of my conversation with him, he referenced right around the time that we were talking about the Supreme Court case, the Affordable Care Act, the switch in time
to save nine.
And he saw this as something that was very much contrary to the inclusiveness of that institution. He has a real problem with what FDR did. And it seems to me that what FDR did, although his tactics may not have been ones that we would want to emulate or cheer about, but in some ways he made that institution more
accountable,
inclusive, and accountable.
Yeah. That's first of all, let me say that Why Nations Fail is awesome. And there's a guy named Ryan Lewis Cooper who works for Washington Monthly, and he has a blog called The Orbital. And he actually wrote this really, because he works for Washington Monthly, he's already read my book because he got an early galley copy and he read a copy of Why Nations Fail. And he did a dual review of them talking about the way that they kind of complement each other. And I've been reading Why Nations Fail thinking, you know, this is a generalized theory, you know, well, this is a generalized theory undertaken by actual genuine academics with genuine expertise and knowledge who spent 15 years researching this. That is a generalized theory for elite failure, basically, the phenomenon that I'm writing about in a more specifically domestic context. But you're right. I mean, I think it gets tricky. You know, at the level of abstraction, it's easy to say things like, let's, you know, make things accountable or more democracy or democratize our institutions or devolve power back down to, you know, local level. But then those bromides and slogans can be used in all sorts of ways that actually entrench power, right? And one of the things I think, and this is, I don't have a way sort of out of that conundrum other than to say, you know, conflict is the essential through line and the foundational bedrock of democracy. You know, the genius of democracy is the fact that it is a way of nonviolently resolving conflict. And the conflict is inherent in the fact that in any society, there are going to be interests that are in conflict. And there are going to be subpopulations because of their cultural identity, tribal affiliations, ideological dispositions, biases and prejudices are going to come into conflict. And so democracy, you know, democracy is an amazing invention. And it when it's working, finds a way to nonviolently resolve all those conflicts. But the conflict never goes away. And I think one of the things that is a theme in Why Nations Fail, and also something I tried to get at in Twilight of the Elites, is that democracy is incredible, but it's also just inherently unstable in certain ways, right? It doesn't ever rest in some easy equilibrium, because all societies tend towards an equilibrium of concentrated power. That is the way the water flows downhill, is towards the collection and pooling of power. And so it's a constant process of vigilance. It's a constant process of agitation. It's a constant process of conflict to keep the democracy essentially afloat, to keep it up on top of the hill, to stop it from the slow and steady, disintegration and erosion of the democratic principles, because democracy and self-governance are incredibly unstable. They're very, very slight when compared to the force and the gravity of the way that oligarchic power tends to exert itself.
And you know, it's interesting because when you talk about America being after a meritocracy, dig into that a little bit, because it's clear that we have moved from a plutonomy to a plutocracy. In other words, that the concentration of wealth has fundamentally led to a concentration of power.
Yeah.
What is the failure of the meritocracy imply there?
So I think, you know, the meritocracy is a way that, you know, so there's a long history. There's long been a tension in America between our democratic commitments on the one hand, our egalitarian commitments, and the fact that the nation was founded by a bunch of pretty affluent, privileged. Oh, I don't know. I think that's me playing a video for you folks at home. There you go. Sorry about that.
No, I didn't hear it. That's fine.
Oh, you didn't. Sorry. So I think there's long been this tension, right? It goes all the way back to the founders, right? I mean, a nation, you know, for this shining example of democracy built on slavery, et cetera, et cetera. And the back and forth between our kind of egalitarian impulses and our inegalitarian impulses, our elitist impulses, have produced all sorts of different ways in which an elite has been constituted and then kind of broken up. And I think the basic thesis of the book is that in the wake of the social upheavals of the 1960s, we sort of left behind the old Protestant establishment and created this new kind of way of constituting the elite, which was the meritocracy, which was by its own both institutional structure and self-avowed ideological vision, much more open, more diverse, right? Open to, you know, it shunned bias, right? And that it was going to get everyone from the poor Puerto Rican kid in the Bronx to the working class son of the West Virginia coal miner to the Philadelphia suburban kid who was Jewish, who had formerly been banned by the Ivy League, that everyone was going to have this opportunity, the vaunted equal playing field, and the institutions would select the best and brightest, and we would have up at the top of this meritocratic order the best and brightest drawn from all ranks and strata of society. And that just has proved to be a completely illusory promise that is not actually verifiably the case. In fact, the core idea of the book is that the kind of fatal sin of the meritocracy is the belief that you can separate equality of outcomes from equality of opportunity, that you can tolerate higher and higher levels of inequality of outcomes, and that won't subvert equality of opportunity. And so what we've had is the meritocracy, I think, in the last 30 years has kind of imploded in on itself. Empirically, we see social mobility either maintaining or declining based on the study you see, while we see inequality accelerating, and we see a process of de-democratization. We see the fact that it's easier to predict your lifelong income potential or even your SAT score by your parents' income, right?
Right.
And this has all happened under the aegis, under the sort of shared consensus vision of a meritocracy where everyone always talks about leveling the playing field, which is why we put more and more pressure on the educational system to expiate the sins of the rest of the society, right? Because we understand there's this deep contradiction between what we're saying we're going for and what the system's actually producing. And I basically, in the same way that at a certain point, I think you had to say to true believers in Marxism who wanted to tell you, no, you don't understand. True Marxism has never been implemented, right? At a certain point, you have to say, well, maybe there's actually something embedded in it theoretically that produces these bad results. I want people who think, no, the problem is we're just not living up to the ideals of the meritocracy, right? I want people who, and this includes, good liberals, high achieving liberals, to think about maybe actually basing a society on a vision as manifestly inegalitarian as the meritocracy is fundamentally flawed to begin with.
Well, and part of that is because what is merit? I mean, right. Isn't it? I mean, it's we have specific cultures and we have specific groups that we're determining essentially what really constitutes merit. And so, you know, thus we get education reform, which is based upon a specific type of notion of what education is supposed to achieve.
Yep.
We get a notion of what society, what success is in society, based upon a very specific notion of accumulating things in a way that comes from a specific culture.
Yep.
And so there's something fundamentally wrong with the way that we even construct meritocracy. In fact, it's not just that the system, our system of merit doesn't work. It's that the fundamentals of the way that we develop that system are problematic.
Right. And you're right that, you know, Amartya Sen has a great essay on meritocracy where he tries to pin down just what we mean by merit. And it proves to be once you subject it to some rigorous examination, it's a very difficult concept to pin down. It very easily slides into it's just, you know, merit is what the people who are privileged have.
Right.
Right. It gets kind of reverse defined that way.
Or what they value.
Or what they value. Right. Exactly. And then that's the first part of the argument about the way this gets produced. And then the results to me are the fact that, you know, we talk a lot, and this is basically to the extent, you know, I will be frank, very frank that, you know, I think the book is an attempt to synthesize in a novel way a bunch of sort of disparate threads. But it's not like I'm saying things about inequality or democracy that have never been said before. To the extent there's a novel observation in the book or a novel core to the argument, it is the fact that to make us think about the ways inequality make the elite worse, which is not the conversation we have about inequality. The entire inequality conversation we have about inequality is about fairness on the left or just desserts on the right, right? Incentives for job creators. But there's a degree to which the more elitist a society gets, the more elitist American society gets, the worse the caliber of elites it produces. Because actually, one of the geniuses of democracy, one of the geniuses of accountability is that it forces a kind of cognitive openness in the elites, right? When you have to deal with people, when you have to deal with all kinds of different feedback coming from different sectors of society, you produce a more stable system from an engineering perspective. And one of the dangers that we've seen play out, I mean, we've seen play out in the most grisly detail, right? And I document in chapter 7 of the book all the ways in which social distance, which is the sort of name I give to this distance between elites and non-elites, the ways that social distance produces crisis. And so to the extent that you have an increasingly cut off elite, you know, you're bound to have, say, the subprime crisis, right?
Right. I mean, this is, you know, I think Jared Diamond's Collapse talks about this idea of nations failing when you have an elite that is essentially sequestered in gated communities of the mind, as it were,
yeah,
or socially, as you're talking about. And so this is, where does this change, though, from? I mean, you know, so is your hope that some of the elite, as they are now, will read the book and say, you know, my God, we're doing this wrong. When I go to the Harvard Club today, we're going to talk about this.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, look, I think the book is pretty frank about the fact that, like, I'm implicated in this, right? I mean, I'm not talking about some other, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't. And in fact, over the course of the 2 years that the book has been in writing, right, my own status vis-a-vis the elite has gotten more and more enmeshed.
Right.
And in some ways, the book is me trying to kind of work that out, you know, emotionally, personally, psychologically. But first of all, I want people to subject the basic consensus framework of meritocracy, which I think the majority of kind of right-thinking liberals share, and not for a bad reason. I think there are really laudable aspirational parts of meritocracy that are morally appealing, right? I want people to second guess them. I want them to think about whether it really is a system that is tenable, whether the fact that we repeatedly don't live up to its ideals is just an accident of us botching the execution, or there's something actually embedded in the vision that dooms it itself to failure, right? I also think in terms of change, you know, one of the things I think is interesting in terms of the formulation of the 99% versus the 1%, which I think is really brilliant, because it's actually grounded in some a lot of empirical data, but also, you know, the top 9% of it, you know, the top 2 to 10% of society, that's a pretty powerful group of people, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a fulcrum of change conceivable in essentially a radicalized upper middle class who feels dispossessed by the genuine plutocrats.
the fractional inequality.
Yes, exactly. And I think that there is, you know, and you see some of that. You see kind of a different strains and varietals of what you might call, you know, upper middle class, mass affluent radicalization. Now, some of that can be just kind of blinkered. Some of it can be really ugly, like a lot of the Tea Party is. But it also, you know, if you go back to the French Revolution, of course, right, it wasn't the peasants necessarily, although the peasants were active and the urban poor were active, but the kind of driving force, and this is something that Marx identified quite aptly, right, and talked about all was the bourgeoisie as a revolutionary class. And the reason they were the revolutionary class is because they had enough power, financial capital, social capital, wherewithal, and education to be a powerful political force and also to acutely feel their own dispossession.
I think of that guy in the Egyptian. Who was the Google executive?
Yeah, Wael
Ghanem, I think.
Wael Ghanem.
And he of course fits that bill, I think, perfectly.
Yeah, no, he's a perfect example, and that's, you know, I mean, that often is the case in different movements of social upheaval and revolution. And, you know, not that I think the United States needs a revolution in the sort of traditional terms we understand that word, but it does need some really deep fundamental mass reformation. And I think that there is potential there. Now, there's a whole lot of things standing in the way of that, but I think, you know, to the extent my book can play some role, I do think having people think more about the cost of inequality society-wide as opposed to just the sort of moral perception of whether it's fair or not is really important. And having people who have been produced by the meritocratic system, who have to some extent been its winners, come to question it, is also really important.
What do you think changed? I mean, if we're in the twilight of the elites, what brought us to that point?
I think there's a few answers to that. One, there's a confluence of macroeconomic, global, geopolitical, financial changes that have happened in the world, having to do with globalization, having to do with sort of neoliberal hegemony, having to do with increasing returns to technology and information manipulation, et cetera, that have kind of come together to help drive this inequality trend, which is not just limited to the U.S., but actually has been happening everywhere in the world except for Latin America, where it has been reversed. And actually, Latin America, I think, is a good way, a good counterexample to show that it doesn't have to be this way, right? So, you know, there's a bunch of sort of historically contingent roots of this. That said, you know, mostly I think that the answer is we had a period of social upheaval and a set of egalitarian movements that created a new social order that then, like all social orders, started to tend towards oligarchy. and I think that is essentially just the nature of America, of human social interaction. And it goes back to the point I was saying in the beginning about democracy is inherently unstable. And there's a theorist on this who I cite in the book, who has become really central to my way of understanding a lot of this, a guy by the name of Robert Michels, who is a German sociologist, student of Max Weber, who was a radical anarcho-syndicalist, socialist, and then later fascist, who retired in Italy as Mussolini's favorite professor. And he wrote a book in 1911 called Political Parties. And he asked this question, which is a really profound question, and I cite it in the book and write a lot about it, where he says, you know, he's dealing with the left-wing parties of a sort of proto-democratic Germany. And he says, you know, I look at the parties on the right, and they're explicitly aristocratic and inegalitarian and oligarchic in their orientation, and that's the way their parties are organized, which makes sense. But us, the parties on the left, we're egalitarian Democrats, and yet our parties are completely hierarchical and totally oligarchic. Why is this the case? And he comes up with what he calls the iron law of oligarchy, which he basically says a tendency towards oligarchy is embedded in the very nation of organization. The famous line in the book is, who says organization says oligarchy. Mm-hmm. And there's something really profound about that, and profoundly true, I think. And the lesson is, you know, ultimately he kind of comes away with a sort of depressing nihilist lesson about it, which is that, well, since oligarchy is, you know, inevitable anyway, I'm going to go and be a fascist. But I think there's a kind of, you know, there's the famous Camus essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, which is about the sort of the final line of, I think, that essay is, one imagines Sisyphus happy. And the idea is that the actual process of the struggle is the thing that is sublime, is the thing that is elevated and enlivening. And I think that's true about self-governance and democracy, that there is no final resting state, and that it is rolling the rock up the hill over and over. And we just haven't rolled the rock up the hill recently.
I mean, that's basically it. There's no sort of there's no sort of contextual, I mean, and maybe that is the technology and moving into sort of a period of new technology sort of leads, sort of creates the sort of breaks down the immune system, I guess, to that sort of ongoing onslaught of oligarchy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think in terms of the way, I do think there's an opportunity now, and that I do think that there is a genuine democratizing potential of technology that we have now, and that can be oversold and often is, but it also is there. I mean, I think it's very hard to look at the way, you know, things went down in the Middle East and not say that that played a crucial role. It was maybe necessary, but certainly not sufficient for what happened there, but. You know, I think there's, I guess you divide it up into things that are kind of, that are contingent, that are contextual, that do have to do with the way that the economy is developed. And in some ways, to be honest, I mean, I think those sources of where we are have been pretty well documented and mined and written about. You know, it's not that I don't think that, you know, the attack on, say, labor unions that, you know, was a very concerted product of a very specific political project, or the ways in which the post-Bretton Woods global financial order was constructed to benefit capital. You know, all those things are playing their role. I just think those are parts of the story that have been told.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, I mean, the last time we went through something like this, is FDR. And, yeah. I just wonder, was FDR a fluke? In other words, have we gone past the point of no return?
No, I don't. I don't think so. And I think, you know, I think it's important to sort of not end up in that alley of despair, partly because, you know, I mean,
there's no value in it.
Well, there's no value in it. And I also just think it's not actually particularly historically informed. I mean, you know, slavery was a lot worse. Jim Crow was a lot worse. Women not having the vote was a lot worse. I mean, there have been concentrations of power that seem totally unbreakable. I mean,
but let me because, you know, it's interesting because I don't know if you saw this Barney Frank interview. I don't want to be the guy who, you know, Atreus apparently at the end of his Wanker of the Decade post basically said, we're fucked. And yeah. And I don't want to be and it's really hard to do a daily show. If that is the premise, because, right. You know, then you just run out of things to talk about. But Barney Frank, you know, there was one thing that struck me in that interview. Well, there was many things. I mean, it's a really great interview. But he talks about how he says that, you know, if people are on the left are too prone to do things that are emotionally satisfying and not politically useful. He said, yeah. I have a rule. If it's true of Occupy, it's true of the gay rights movement. If you care deeply about a cause and you're engaged in an activity on behalf of that cause, it's great fun. It makes you feel good and warm and enthusiastic. You're probably not helping because you're out there with your friends and political work is much tougher and harder. And he talks about how he's going to write a book about the LGBT movement and how they've had increasing success. Mm-hmm. And there seems to me that there may be a fundamental difference between social emancipation of specific groups and economic emancipation.
Yeah.
Because there, you know, there's something zero sum here and you're playing against people, your adversaries in wresting that power, they have everything to lose, at least in their mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think there is a distinction. First of all, I think in a lot of cases, the two are related. I mean, you know, social and economic emancipation certainly went hand in hand, particularly for women, I think, in the way that we think about feminism and what has happened to women in both levels of educational attainment, the narrowing of pay gap, et cetera. In certain cases, I think the two can't be as neatly cleaved. I mean, I think that, you know, part of what I write about in the book is that, you know, part of it has to do, I think, with the dominant ethos that people subscribe to, which is the kind of, you know, Bloomberg can get behind gay marriage because it does fit within the meritocratic ethos that the American elite broadly buys into, but he's not going to get behind a living wage.
Right. And it doesn't, you know, threaten his worldview in the same way.
Right. No. I think that worldview is not, you know, that worldview is not set in stone. And there is, we have gone through periods where there's been more or less concentrated economic power in this country. And periods where it was concentrated in a way that, you know, was even worse than we have now. There is something, you know, I guess I fundamentally have a faith in the sort of self-corrective potential of democracy. It just seems a little historically blinkered to me to think that we've reached some terminus now when if you survey back, you know, I mean, imagine fighting for an income tax in 1890, right? I mean, that's just insane. A constitutional amendment for an income tax? I mean, that just seems like a totally impossible project. But, you know, they got it done.
Or did they?
Right. You know. Nice Ron Paul shout out there.
Yes.
I think about the activists in Tunisia or Egypt who basically, you know, woke up every day with rolling the boulder, only to get crushed by it over and over, you know, this entirely, what must have seemed a totally hopeless enterprise for so long. And then, you know, things really changed. I don't think there's anything fundamentally you end up at a place in these discussions where you're essentially adverting to a certain kind of faith.
Right.
And I just, if I have a single faith, it's a kind of democratic faith.
Well, I appreciate you're sticking with us and just I have to ask you this cause I did. And you mentioned it briefly. I'm curious how having a show and sort of, you know, the changes that you have experienced over the past couple of years, how has that sort of changed your perspective? Because, you know, I think, you know, for me, when I started to get more involved in this, when I started to do radio coming from sort of a more entertainment background, I was sort of shocked and, you know, maybe it's a little bit more gradual of sort of an understanding for you. But I was sort of shocked at just sort of I had sort of perceived there was a lot more responsibility amongst, you know, it was another aspect of my sort of realizing that the elite and in this case, sort of the media elite were just not really up to snuff in many respects. And I'm curious how has it changed? How is having a show and being sort of enmeshed in that world changed your perspective on it?
You know, I have to say that I don't know how much it has changed my perspective insofar as I tend to be very focused on it. It's almost like we're this little, you know, satellite within this big constellation. So much of what we do there is just, you know, is thinking about what we do for our show and who we put on our show and how we make our show as good as our show can be. And then the other show that I have a fair amount of interaction with are the two others is Melissa's show, which, you know, I have just tremendous admiration and respect for, and Rachel's, Rachel Maddow's, which again, same feeling. And I sort of think in some ways, you know what, here's one thing I would say. There's a lot less in the way of like scary corporate censorship than I think I would have thought, you know, mm-hmm. Like we can talk about whatever we're going to talk about. Really? I mean, maybe we can't, and I just haven't hit up against the boundaries yet, but my sense is, you know, if it's good television and it's responsible, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't think we could get away with, nor should we be able to get away with, you know, getting on national television and saying someone's a child molester without any, like, you know, so obviously there are some boundaries. But I think for the most part, I think to the degree there's a kind of, sameness that people feel about quote unquote corporate media, it's much more the product, and this is something that I've observed firsthand on Capitol Hill. It's much more the product of peer effects and kind of cultural consensus and mechanisms of production, you know, not having being short staffed, having to produce a daily hour of content, et cetera, than it is anything more, explicit than that. And this is not to say that you don't get hegemony and you don't get, you know, the corporate media does, you know, define certain things as outside the bounds of polite conversation and certain things as reasonable ideas when they're not. But all that's produced by this kind of, by this very complicated set of cultural peer effects, in a much more subtle way than, you know, anything that has to do with, you know, a memo from the head of the company saying, right, don't talk about this. Now, I think at Fox, there are memos from the head of the company saying, don't talk about this.
Of course.
And there may be in other places too. But so I think that so much of, you know, here's one thing I will say. So much of the way elites behave is conditioned by them wanting to impress their peers. Right. And so much of whether they're behaving well or not is dependent on who their peer set, who they consider their peers to be, you know? And I know that psychologically for myself, that's partly the case. Like the people that I'm friends with and respect, whose politics I respect, like I don't want, you know, I don't want Sam Cedar, for instance, to send me an email being like, dude, that was really, you know, that was really crappy, your thing on, you know, like that. And that goes through my mind. And that is a really powerful psychological impulse. And that accounts for a lot of what you see.
Right. I mean, I think that's also, I mean, it seems to me that runs in power. I mean, it's consistent with what is problematic with the elites in general, is that their peer groups are just, it sort of spirals down. It's sort of like this spiraling down. It's this feedback loop. And unfortunately there's no one in that feedback loop in many of these circles that is going to send that email.
Right. And I think that's the thing you have to be careful of, you know, is just like, I think that's the really scary thing, is you don't want to lose touch. You know, is, you know, how do you not become out of touch? How do you not become a sort of, you know, end up with this set of peers that are all out of touch themselves and only kind of, you know, and only worry about their opinion and end up in a place that's really, detached and remote and, clueless. And I, you know, that's a challenge to me. The great thing about reporting is that it is forcing you constantly to kind of touch ground.
Right.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, the way our show is constructed is kind of like live real-time reporting. It's like, yeah, come on my show and tell me about what you've seen and what you've heard and what you know. And you know, we're trying to not fall into the trap of just booking the same people over and over again and falling into that kind of easy groove. So,
Well, I got to tell you, I've told you before, I'm a huge fan of the show. I think this weekend was the first weekend I have not watched it as of yet, because I was in Disney World.
How was Disney World?
It was, it was difficult to sort of parse between my between Disney World and going with my father-in-law.
Right.
And so there was
that's a whole other hour program.
Yes, there is a lot of different factors that were sort of completely. I did notice there's a lot less Mickey Mouse, and it's all about their sort of their branding of their different characters, which, you know, my 6-year-old daughter, when we would sit down to talk about that, she didn't seem to be bothered by it. So,
right.
The show is great, and I think you're doing, you know, I continue to enjoy it, and I also feel obligated to tell you a slight amount of guilt. I took 5 minutes of your content a week or two ago on the Commerce Clause.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. That's great.
I replayed it.
Yeah, I heard that. That's good.
I'll send NBC a check.
No, exactly. Yeah, you'll be hearing from our lawyers.
All right. Well, Chris Hayes, I can't wait for the book to come out, and we'll have you back on hopefully at that time. And thanks for taking the time.
We'll have you back on.
Well, there you go.
All right, man. It was great to catch up.
All right, appreciate it. Hey guys, listeners of the Majority Report know that we try and put our money where our mouth is when it comes to our sponsors. And I can't say enough about Credo Mobile. They're our newest sponsor. They're the only progressive cell company out there. This is really the best of both worlds for me. I'm so excited, I can barely even say the words. We get to support an organization that fights Republican Tea Party extremists, one that holds Democrats accountable, one that funds the progressive movement, and finally helps keep this show on the air. It's really easy for you to sign up now. Go to credomobile.com/majority. That's credomobile.com/majority. You'll get 40% off your monthly voice fee for 1 year. You'll get true unlimited data. No hinky-dinky, you went over with your megabytes. And they'll even give you a buyout credit of $350 to get out of your contract with one of the big corporate providers that you're stuck with now, so that when you show them your bill, essentially, you won't pay a Credo bill until you go over $350. It's a great deal. Go to credomobile.com/majority right now. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a real pleasure for me to have our next guest back on the program. And now, having finally read his book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, which you can purchase right now via our link at majority.fm. Chris Hayes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for reading it, Sam.
I got to say, I mean, now, we've had conversations about a lot of the things that ended up in this book over the past couple of years, and I've read the excerpts. But I got to say, I was still I was surprised. This is an incredibly ambitious book, and it's a little bit radical. I mean, you know, I don't mean to say that, you know, like I just didn't realize, like, this goes beyond politics. I mean, this is a fundamentally a social critique of the way that we do business in our society.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, it is. I think there is part of it that's radical. I mean, I think the, in some ways, one of the core tensions of the book and one of the core tensions I wrestle with, and I think it comes out in different places, is sort of balancing my kind of radical impulses and my ameliorist liberal reformist impulses. And, you know, and I, at one point I refer in the book to my inner David Brooks, which is a non-trivial part of me, right? This worry about, you know, traditions and institutional performance and moral norms and things like that. It was a big undertaking. I mean, I was lucky enough that the timing was such that I signed the book and I had about 18 months, which is longer than usually you get. Usually you get only about a year. And the folks at The Nation were really cool about me spending a lot of time writing it. And I didn't have the show yet for most of it. So that made it possible.
I feel like another half a dozen books could be written based upon the things that you hit at certain point that would inspire literally a half a dozen other books. I mean, I thought it really is a fascinating book. I've like sitting here with it and it's sort of unbelievable. I have like 43, I'll show it to the camera here. I got about 43 different post-it notes through this thing. So let's try it. I really enjoyed it. And at one point I was like, oh gee, this is pretty radical. Let's just start with the iron law of meritocracy, because this is this is not just sort of saying there's a not the iron law of meritocracy, but your book is not simply saying that there's a problem for the elites here. There is something fundamentally wrong with the way that we, in some ways, organize our society.
Yeah, I mean, I think the social model we have, which we call the meritocracy, and it's the social model that we've adopted, you know, explicitly and implicitly for over the last 30 years or so. And I think what's interesting about meritocracy, just as a topic, right? A, we don't really debate it or talk about it much because it is pretty foundational. It's the floor that we walk on, right? And it's something that's, I think, bipartisan consensus. And, you know, Barack Obama uses the language of the meritocracy. Mitt Romney uses the language of the meritocracy. And I think liberals and conservatives, I mean, I think we have different definitions of it and different feelings, but it's a pretty deep part of the way that we think about how American life should be. And one of the ironies about the word, which I read about in the book, is that, you know, the word was coined by a leftist British social critic and parliamentarian named Michael Young, who wrote this book in 1955 called The Rise of the Meritocracy, in which he coined the term. And it was this dystopic vision of the future in which intelligence testing and productivity testing within firms had grown incredibly precise, and they had given up on the idea of democracy. And they say that explicitly. Like, we realize that democracy could be no more than an aspiration. Instead, what we want is a meritocracy, which is, you know, rule by those with the most merit. You know, they test to figure out what students should get the best jobs and who inside an organization is delivering the most value. And they elevate them to positions of power. And Young was writing a dystopic satire, right? I mean, Young was basically saying, this is a horrible vision for how to order a society. And he was aghast at the end of his life to see the term be adopted positively. I mean, in America, when you call something meritocratic, you are praising it. And when you call something bureaucratic, you're insulting it, right? I mean,
right. I mean,
no one ever says...
And I want to just back up here a little bit so that people can really sort of firmly grasp this, because as we speak of the meritocracy in this country, we're talking about, like, if you're smart, you'll rise to the top. If you are, there's not going to be any nepotism. There's not going to be any sort of, you come from one class, so you deserve this. And this was a notion that probably, I mean, we've had in this country for a long time. It was just sort of more narrowly, it was, you know, this applied in the same way that all men are created equal,
right,
applied
exactly.
to just a narrow yeah. sect of people. So
that's exactly right. It's sort of a new version of an old dream, right? Of boundless mobility, of being able to rise from any station as far as your talents and abilities will take you. De Tocqueville noted this aspiration, right? When he wrote about the U.S., he said this is a place that doesn't have the inheritance of feudalism, doesn't have the word peasant because the class is unknown here. Of course, that's because we had slaves, but that's another story. So the meritocracy is a way of it's so it's two things, okay? It's a social model that you describe where we say we won't bar people from entrance into the elite based on their religion and their race and their creed and their geographic origins. And in fact, Barack Obama is the crowning glory, the crowning achievement of that system. Only under this system of meritocracy could a man from his background with his name and skin color go through, you know, an elite prep school and then Harvard and Columbia and Harvard Law and go on to become president of the United States. And that's, I think, a point in the meritocracy's favor. I mean, I think it's an incredible thing that someone like Barack Obama could be president. But at the same time, the notion we have of dividing neatly the quality of outcomes, right, which is how much money people make and how much power they accrue from a quality of opportunity, the mythical level playing field, we want to divide those two and say we're going to focus on equality of opportunity. And what I argue in the book and what I talk about in terms of the iron law of meritocracy is that they cannot be divided. That ultimately inequality of outcomes come to subvert, co-opt, and destroy the attempts to provide equality of opportunity.
And so people should understand that the what you argue throughout the book is that meritocracy as a system ultimately cannot work. Is that accurate? It's fatally flawed.
That it contains the seeds of its own destruction. It's not a stable final state. That it always tends towards oligarchy. That it will always be the case that the people who make it to the top find ways to game the system so that they can stay at the top, or that their kids can stay at the top. And, you know, we see this in all kinds of ways. I mean, just real flagrant violations, right? Legacy admissions at elite colleges, or admissions for the students, the children of extremely wealthy people who donate a wing to a science lab at a, you know, Ivy League university. But we also see it in less flagrant ways. I mean, at my high school embodies this meritocratic vision, Hunter College High School in Manhattan, amazing place, public magnet school starting grade 7, open to kids from all 5 boroughs, free. And I took the test, and I was 11 years old, standing outside on a cold winter day, along with a lot of other kids, a lot of outer borough strivers. You know, it's an amazing engine of social mobility, or could be. And what we've seen over time at the school is that the inequality of the city has meant that Black and Latino students are underrepresented, and white and Asian students are overrepresented. And that has gotten worse as a test prep industry has grown up around the test for the school. So you have $90 an hour tutors in Manhattan, you have in the Queens, you have cram schools where you pay $1,000 to send your kid to a school for a week, and you know, over winter break and study for the test, and now you're seeing the number of Black and Latino students dwindle to 3% and 1% respectively, and people inside the school worrying about the first class that they will admit that won't have a single Black or Latino student. And this is a perfect example of how even the most austere vision of a meritocracy, right? I mean, the great thing about Hunter is that it really is one test, and it isn't that gameable. I mean, if Mayor Bloomberg's daughter failed the test, she wouldn't be able to get in.
Right. Okay, well, I mean, but let me ask you, is this, are we talking about sort of the corruption of the meritocracy? In other words, the corruption in the sense that the system doesn't work, or that there's something ultimately wrong about the system? When you talk about it in the dystopic version, this is the type of thing that we hear about in places like the former Soviet Union or in North Korea. You know, if the kid at age 7 shows that they have an aptitude for ballet or for gymnastics, this is what they're going to do. Period. And, and this is the way those things are sort of, their roles and their futures are laid out. Is the problem that the meritocracy as a system ultimately will eat itself, or is that it starts out fundamentally wrong?
You know, that there's a tension, I think, that I haven't resolved in the book about between those two. The argument I'm making is actually about the fact that it will ultimately eat itself. But I also think the vision of it is in deep tension with our democratic commitments. I mean, you know, democracy, I mean, in Michael Young's book, The Rise of Meritocracy, meritocracy is explicitly advocated as a kind of repudiation of democracy. And I think that we've gotten away from just how radical the small-d democratic commitment is, that we all will make decisions together about what we all are going to do. And that means, at its core, the people you ride the subway with, the people that you stand in line with at the grocery store, the people at work who you cannot stand, right? I mean, and there's that vision, which is what the vision of democracy is a really, really radical one. And it's one that I don't think we really appreciate or embrace anymore that much.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the other problems with the meritocracy as it stands is that we also don't necessarily have an appreciation of the sort of the arbitrariness as to what we value. I mean, you talk in the book about the culture, I think you call it the culture of smart.
Cult of smart.
And, you know, what we seem to have, you talk about two different periods of equality, the one, you know, essentially starting in the 60s till now, and the one prior to that, where one was a more economic equality and then one became more socially emancipated equality, which mm-hmm. led to or didn't necessarily lead to, but coincided with a greater increase in economic inequality. But it seems to me that the values that ultimately we now refer to that dictate the meritocracy did not necessarily absorb the new values that may have come in broadening who could participate in it. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think one of the problems with meritocracy is that upon further investigation, merit is tougher to define than it might first look, right? Like, that's a huge issue with the entire system, because, you know, what we end up defining it at is on Wall Street is how much money you can produce, and in higher education and law school, it's intelligence. But it's intelligence defined in a very narrow way, which is how well you test, which is just quite distinct from the actual attribute of intelligence. And so I think that the flattening effect that has is really, really destructive. And it produces the fact that we think in very one-dimensional ways about who has value, right? We think about, you know, that that is something, you know, talking about the era between the New Deal and the 1970s and high levels of unionization. You know, the labor movement is a repudiation of that idea. The labor movement says that everyone has value because of the work they do, right? That it's not that it's not just the intellectual superstars and the A students who have value. Everyone has value, and everyone should have good work, and everyone should have work that rewards them and allows them a certain degree of comfort, particularly in a wealthy and affluent society like our own. And I remember having this moment when I was reporting on Detroit for the book, which I ended up not including any of it in. But I drove up to the house of an auto worker in Grand Rapids, and he was a retired auto worker, really, you know, fascinating guy who'd done a lot of writing and pamphleteering and been active in the union and had been battling the union hierarchy for a lot of reasons. And I drove up to his house, and I had this thought flash through my mind about, you know, this house looks like the kind of house that if it was in Brooklyn or in the New York area, would be owned by someone who is a partner at a major law firm, right?
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, oh, that's the whole point. Like, that somehow really clarified exactly the difference between these two visions. Because the vision we have now is the vision that you only get to have that kind of house if you go through all these hoops, if you battle through this set of competitions to get this scarce resource at the top. And the vision that we had before that was embodied by the labor movement was a vision that, no, if you work, if you do productive work, you can have a nice house, right? And that's a very different vision than the meritocracy. The meritocracy is part of what makes it so intensely distorting in terms of people's psychology and neuroses and competition is that it takes for granted that there's going to be some scarce small set of good jobs and fulfilling endeavors at the end of the funneling process.
Right.
And so everything from the time that you start jostling to get your kid into the right kindergarten in New York is a lifelong competition for that incredibly scarce resource. But that's a perverted way of thinking about an economy. I mean, we should be thinking about an economy that produces lots of fulfilling good jobs and opportunity for lots of different people.
And the rules that structure that competition, in other words, you know, if we sat on a soccer field and we decided at one point that, like, no, the winner is not going to be the one who gets the most goals. The winner is going to be the one who keeps the ball in play for the longest.
Right.
I mean,
that's right.
It's a completely arbitrary decision that we're making at that point. And if it could very well be that keeping the ball in play for a long time brings out a bunch of ties. And
right.
And that's really where it gets to. That's why I think to a certain extent the book is fairly radical, because I think I don't think that people realize just how much we have internalized this notion of not just the idea of a meritocracy, but a very specifically defined idea of a meritocracy.
That's right. That
values attributes that lead to hyper competition, and you talk about
hyper competition and also self-justification. I mean, the most perverse consequence of this is this: what Karen Ho, who's this great anthropologist who wrote a great study of Wall Street that called Liquidated, that I cite in the book, which she calls the meritocratic feedback loop. I mean, this worshiping of this cult of smartness, in which you think about smartness as this very easily identifiable, definable, and ordinal trait, right? Like height. Michael Jordan is shorter than Yao Ming, but he's taller than Danny DeVito. So-and-so is smarter than so-and-so, but not as smart as such-and-such, right? That's a really perverse way about thinking about people and about competition and about ranking. Even more perverse is the meritocratic feedback loop on Wall Street, in which money itself is what merit is. If you make a lot of money, then that shows, by definition, that you are deserving. That's a dangerous, dangerous way of thinking about making money, because it's naturally self-justifying. And that is the culture on Wall Street, very, very explicitly the culture on Wall Street. That number, that bonus that you fight for at the end of the year, that is your value. That is your merit. That is a reflection of it, and in some senses, an objective reflection of it.
You talk about how this destroyed. This was what Enron was at the end. I'm in the midst of reading another book about the big Bayou hedge fund fraud, and it's all. I mean, it literally is. You know, it's all about this notion of how money is self-justifying, how the elite have essentially been corrupted by this notion. Every guy that this guy met in his way to creating this sort of fraudulent hedge fund, which was ultimately taken down because he got conned, was all... This guy got conned because he thought that he was told by a con man that there was a even more secret rigged international bond trading market that only the super, super elite. And I mean, it really does describe how this sort of notion where this feedback loop begins to sort of, it both justifies where they are and creates the notion that there are people sort of on top of them in some way.
That you always have to keep scrambling up the ladder. I mean, there's two aspects of this. One is, I cite C.S. Lewis giving this incredible address.
Well, that was the next thing I wanted to go, because this is fascinating to me. Tell us about this.
He has this. It's a beautiful speech, beautiful essay. You can look it up online. It's called The Inner Ring, and he basically says, you know, he's talking to these people about to graduate. He says, have you ever had the experience, and I think this relates to the point you were just making, you ever had the experience where you walk into a room, there's two people speaking, and they hush up when you walk in? Then you have had the experience of coming up against the inner ring. It's the knowledge that there's some inner ring that you are on the outside of. And C.S. Lewis says, you will find in your life that the desire to be on the right side of that dividing line, to be on the inside of the inner ring, will be the seedbed for corruption, for almost everything you do in your life that is wrong. You will look back on your life, and when you will identify those moments of transgression, the moments you're ashamed of, as having been undertaken because of the desire to be in the inner ring. And I think that's a profound moral insight. And I think at some level, the system of meritocracy is nothing if not a series of inner rings. Explicitly, it's a funneling process. It's constantly wanting to be closer to the core of power or the core of status or the core of money. And so it is also a system of constant temptation for corruption. And one of the things you see in the book when you're talking about the hedge fund, which is a perfect example of that, right? He thought he was on the inner ring, but then there's right. some other secret inner ring that is a super secret deal that ends up being his undoing. But also in environments, Enron and Major League Baseball are two that I talk about along with Wall Street. In environments that are explicitly designed along meritocratic lines, that have high rewards for performance, punishment for failure, it turns out it's trickier than it looks to design a system with high rewards for performance that isn't also a system with high rewards for cheating. And that's basically what happened in Major League Baseball. At a certain point, the norm against cheating broke down. As soon as someone introduced steroids and saw that it was advantageous, the ceaseless competition of the system meant that it was widely adopted. And that happened in Enron. I mean, let's remember, Enron has huge, huge bonuses at the top and also fired 10% of their workforce every 2 years in what they called rank and yank for the lowest rated employees. And here's the thing, people that worked at Enron will tell you it actually was a pretty meritocratic place. They liked that about it. It wasn't bureaucratic. It wasn't about the favored son of some manager. But of course, the flip side of that is exactly the kind of moral decay that we saw. And that I think is a really important point, because I think when we think about meritocracy, we don't think about the cost of it. We don't think about these incentives and seductions towards corner cutting, corruption, breaking moral norms.
And in fact, this is what I think people who rail against the so-called school reform movement with all of this testing, that's what they're really concerned about, is that you're setting up a system which measures the value of a school based on these metrics that supposedly fit into whether or not the school merits more funding or to continue on or a special place. And all that it does is it increases the pressure to cheat, and it undercuts the value of education.
Yeah, I mean, we're under a national experiment in which we're converting the model of teachers from a bureaucratic one to a meritocratic one explicitly. That is the goal, right? Accountability, punishment for failure, rewards for performance in the form of merit pay, constant measuring and metrics, and competition amongst teachers to produce those numbers. And the analysis of my book suggests we should not be surprised if we see an epidemic of cheating. Because that's what those kinds of systems produce, and we are seeing it. You know, what's happening in Atlanta is jaw-dropping. You have principals hosting pizza parties where people come in and they change test numbers, right?
Well, at least they're giving them pizza. That really gets to the nub. I mean, you don't touch on the school movement, but that notion of the meritocracy it encourages cheating, and I want to just double back, because you know, you talked about these two eras of equality, and I wonder, because by the end you talk about you start getting to when you start talking about the Reformation, you start talking about the problem with meritocracy is that it's sort of a bank shot to equality of outcome in some respects,
right.
And I wonder if when we moved into this new era of equality, I mean,
as flawed as it is, but at least this era of more social emancipation, where theoretically a more diverse group of people could participate in what we now call the meritocracy, if that wasn't sort of the last vestige of trying to maintain power by those people who now had to admit the broader society into this competition, because it is one where you could, despite the fact that theoretically, well, all the inputs are the same, you can then sort of still sort of fudge what the outcomes are, because you still have this sort of meritocracy machine still has sort of inputs that are on the side, and you could sort of, jerry-rig a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fascinating question about whether the connection between, and this is a deep one, it's a profound one, I think, for people with the politics that you and I have, in which we are committed to both things. We're committed to, we're committed to equality along lines of gender and race and sexual orientation, and we're also committed to economic equality. There's a real question about, the relationship between those two trends, the relationship of the trend of opening up the American elite to a more diverse group of people and the decline in the sense of solidarity and collective purpose that was the hallmark of the labor movement specifically, but the economic left in the middle of the 20th century. And I do think there's a relationship, and I do think that what we see now is the story about meritocracy is used to justify the current distribution of outcomes quite explicitly. I mean, that is what Mitt Romney says when Barack Obama talks about education. You know, he talks about inequality. He chalks up the problem with inequality largely to an educational problem. And that's the social consensus at the moment, is we're going to ask the education system to expiate the sins of the rest of society. But, we need to reclaim, and this goes back to what I was saying before about the house in Grand Rapids, and reclaim the vision of shared broad affluence. That was the big mid-century promise of America, which we can deliver today. I mean, people talk about foreshortened horizons and decline and all these things. America remains an incredibly wealthy country. It's an incredibly wealthy place, an incredibly productive country with tremendous productive capacity. In fact, huge amounts of productive capacity, which we are simply not using right now because of this austerity fever, because of the effects of the recession. And there's a story, there's a story that you will hear from hedge fund guys and private equity folks and relatively sophisticated conservatives and conservative economists that says, that period of wage compression in mid-century, that was just a one-off deal where the rest of the world was recovering from the war, we had incredible growth, and we were able to kind of get fat. But that's not the way it is in this new competitive global environment. And remember, competition is the key theme here. In fact, if you read Friedman's The World is Flat, it's very explicitly a story about global meritocracy, right? Where the hardworking and hard charging brainiacs of India and China are going to come eat our lunch. If you look at the facts, America remains a wealthy place. We produce a lot of wealth. We produce a lot of economic activity. And there are different equilibria at which that the distribution of those gains can be. And that's a simple brute fact that we just don't talk about enough.
Well, I mean, our whole society structure. I mean, we could see that debate when it comes to healthcare, because it's where do the princes from Saudi Arabia go to get healthcare? Well, that's fine, but is that really the measure we want of good healthcare when outcomes for the broad amount of people is not as good as it would be in Europe? And I would argue that that President Obama's embrace of the meritocracy, as you describe it in your book, is also a strong I think it's a reflection of the decisions that he made in terms of bailing out the banks and the way that they built his team to look at the what to do with the banks. It was all with the winners who sat atop of this heap, despite the fact that they clearly they were playing a specific game where the winnings go to the winners because they're winners and that's what winnings do. I mean, it just sort of the circular argument. He could very well have decided we're going to bail out the banks by directly bailing out the mortgage holders who will then help the banks rather than saying to the banks, here's some money. We're going to bail you out. Please do the right thing. I mean, it's the difference, it seems to me, of incentivizing the society's winners to help out the rest of us versus helping out the rest of us and allowing society's so-called winners to sort of benefit from that.
Yeah, that the really extreme version of this vision, which is the Ayn Randian version of it, which is the winners, the job creators, the idea that actually those folks are a different species of person, right? And there are different species of person that are almost like the ancient Greek gods who might grow angry with us if we do not placate them. That's really the narrative we get from the Republicans. But it's simply a difference in degree of the way that we think about the meritocracy and the brightest folks rather than a difference in kind. It's simply an extreme extension of that same logic, which concedes that there's some small group of people who should, quote, be in charge. And that when you talk about the book being radical, questioning that fundamental insight, I think, is radical, particularly in the current political context. And at the same time that you call it radical, you know, I had someone who is quite radical read the book and said, you know, this was disappointingly conventionally liberal. and I wrote back and said, you know, in many ways I am. I'm a conventional Rawlsian liberal, John Rawls' theory of justice, redistributive justice. But being a conventional Rawlsian liberal in these times is totally radical because our political conversation is so far from that. It's so far from thinking explicitly about justice, about redistribution, about equality, about our egalitarian commitments front and center as an affirmative vision for a good society. We don't talk in those terms.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting because I think politically speaking, when you start to talk about the Reformation, I mean, it's very hard at this point to say, like, how do you unwind this and what's going to do it? But I think socially speaking, if the idea of the meritocracy, which I think, you know, people don't even discuss this. I mean, I haven't seen many, you know, it's certainly not in the context of politics. That's always you know, where people can agree. And then we start to have different arguments about, branching off from that. But undercutting that very notion of meritocracy, I think, would necessarily lead to political calculations and political movements that would be fundamentally different because you're starting from a different baseline. It's just that it is so accepted, this notion of meritocracy, that, you know, it's like President Obama said in terms of why we couldn't have a single payer. It's just not American in some way. And I think it's only become American more recently, and it is I think it is a reaction to essentially that social emancipation, that we need another mechanism in which to maintain some dominance here.
Hierarchy.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the last thing I want to say in terms of solutions and so forth is, you know, I would love to, you know, Conor Friedersdorf is a really interesting idiosyncratic kind of center-right conservative, but with, you know, his views are hard to characterize. And he wrote a review of the book on The Atlantic, and he said, you know, I like the book and I like the analysis, but I thought his suggestions were obtuse and totally off the mark, and here are what my proposals for, you know, how to fix these problems, how to either recalibrate or reform or replace this meritocratic vision in a way that'll, you know, confer some of the concrete benefits we want. And I was just so heartened by that, because I would love to have a debate. As you said, we don't debate this. I would love to have an explicit debate about it, because we just take for granted this is a social model and it's meant to produce what we want it to produce, and even though it's not producing that. And I would love to have a debate with conservatives, with people from all over the political spectrum, explicitly about whether this social model is working, whether we want to maintain it, if we want to get rid of it, what the America after meritocracy looks like. That would be, I think, a really, really good conversation for us to have.
Yeah, it's certainly well needed. And you anticipate in the book that we're going to have these opportunities, because there's really no there's little reason to believe that we're not going to be faced with crises like the one we went through a couple of years ago, and are still continuing going through in many respects in the years to come. My favorite line was just when you said at one point, like, normalcy must be disrupted. And I mean, I know, you know, we've talked in the past about the Occupy movement, and clearly there needs to be some type of major social movement. You talk about Frances Townsend, who started to basically create a movement for creating an old folks pension system that some credit,
yeah, exactly,
with forcing FDR's hand.
Roosevelt's hand. Isn't that a great piece of hidden history? I think it's just an amazing, amazing story. But yeah, I mean, I think, I do think, you know, one of the weird things about our current moment is that we're kind of idling. You know, the people in charge did do one thing right. When I say people in charge broadly, I say Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, Timothy Geithner, President Obama, Rahm Emanuel, in that period between Lehman Brothers failing and, you know, say the next spring, right? The people in charge did succeed in preventing cataclysm. And cataclysm was absolutely a possibility. And they deserve credit for preventing cataclysm. But the perverse consequence of it is that we now idle in this, what I describe in the book as, we are stalked as a patient with a persistent fever might be, that the feeling isn't, things aren't right, that we haven't gotten better. We're not on our deathbed. We're not in a coma. We're not in the ICU as we could be, but we are also not healthy. And that produces a weird politics, because there's a seduction of the normal, even though the times are abnormal. That's part of what Paul Krugman is tearing his hair out on the pages of the New York Times op-ed page in his book, saying, this is not normal. We cannot acclimate ourselves to this normality. And that's why the politics of disruption are so necessary.
Is to make people realize that this is a problem. And I think, you know, I think we can't sustain this fever for forever. I mean, the question is, you know, at what point does it start to aggregate? At what point, when you have all of these people who have fallen off the unemployment rolls, at what point does it start to sort of reach that critical mass where it comes back? And hopefully we're you know, I mean, there's reason to believe that we're almost at that point again. I guess we'll see. Chris Hayes, I love the book. So glad you could come on and talk about it, and I appreciate your taking so much time.
Oh, I love that you love it, and I really appreciate that you read it, and this is a great conversation, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, good. Chris Hayes, folks.
It's Sam Cedar introducing whiny-ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
Well, Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays, a Christmas tree or a holiday tree? Which should it be? Depends on whom you ask. We've seen controversy, most notably prompted by the White House. It sent out cards, this card, matter of fact, wishing a holiday season of hope and happiness. No mention of Christmas. Some thoughts now on the subject. Sam Teeter hosts the show Majority Report on Air America Radio. Bob Knight is the director of the Culture and Family Institute. It's affiliated with the Christian conservative organization Concerned Women for America. Gentlemen, great to have you with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
All right, well, let's start with the holiday card. What do you think, Sam?
Well, listen, you know, as far as the war on Christmas goes, I feel like we should be waging a war on Christmas. I mean, I believe that Christmas, it's almost proven that Christmas has nuclear weapons, can be an imminent threat to this country, that they have operative ties with terrorists, and I believe that we should sacrifice thousands of American lives in pursuit of this war on Christmas, and hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money.
Well, Sam, is it a war on Christmas, a war on Christians, a war on over political correctness, or just a lot of people with way too much time on their hands?
Well, I would say probably, if I was to be serious about it, too much time on their hands. But I'd like to get back to the operational ties between Santa Claus and Al-Qaeda.
I don't think that exists. Bob?
Well, we have
help
intelligence.
Help me out here.
We have intelligence.
You
we
do,
have intelligence.
You have intel. And where exactly does your intel come from?
Well, we have tortured an elf. And that's it's actually how we got the same information from Al-Labi. That's exactly the same way the Bush administration got this info about the operational ties between Al-Qaeda and Saddam.
Okay, Bob Knight. Sam is tying in now the lack of information regarding weapons of mass destruction and somehow moving that into Santa Claus. Help me out here. What's going on? I mean, is this a war on Christians, a war on Christmas? Is this too much political correctness?
Yeah, it was very, first I want to compliment him on his dry humor, but this is actually a very serious subject because a lot of people are waking up to realize that the war on Christmas is really the culmination of a war on faith. And the idea that the public square has to be cleansed of any religious expression, particularly Christian religious expression. You know, at one time, Happy Holidays was a welcome addition to Merry Christmas, so you wouldn't say the same thing over and over again. But a lot of people now see it as a substitute, and it's very gratuitous at times. And it's actually insulting when you're talking about Christmas Day or a Christmas tree, and you can't bring yourself to use the word for fear of offending someone. In the name of diversity, we're a less free country when that happens.
It's interesting, Sam, because, I mean, this is a time where, if anything, we want to be even more sensitive to diversity, considering everything that's happening with regard to war on terror. We're learning so much more about different religions, different ethnicities, and trying to become more of one versus being segregated.
Yeah, well, Kara, I mean, listen, I would like Bob to tell me who is the person who has been offended by someone saying Merry Christmas to them. I've never met that person. I don't celebrate Christmas. But if someone says Merry Christmas to me and I either think, well, it's a little bit odd. It's like me saying happy birthday to you on my birthday. But, you know, no one cares. But I'll tell you this. As we wage the war on the war on the war on the war on Christmas on our radio show, News Corp, Fox News, those people who have started this entire war on Christmas meme, fake war, they're having a holiday party. President Bush saying happy holidays, Tokyo Rose, Laura Bush, saying happy holidays to her dogs in the video. I'm sure you've seen it. I mean, these are the things that we should be talking about when we are waging this war in Iraq. We should be equating it to the war on Christmas. What else would Bob Knight have an opportunity to do? How else would he get on television if he wasn't pretending to be attacked?
You know, this would be funny, except it is serious to a lot of people who have seen their faith cleansed from the public square systematically.
Well, are you suggesting, Bob, that someone can't celebrate Christmas in America? I mean, tell me about the person who can escape these
celebrations. Get a word in here.
Go ahead, Bob.
I'm talking about things like in Ridgeway, Wisconsin, where the school children in the public school were told they couldn't sing Silent Night, so they substituted O Cold Night. You know, I think when you take Jesus out of anything, it gets pretty cold, so it's apt. But it's outrageous. They had children actually singing a bastardized version of Silent Night.
Well, Bob,
you see,
this
Christmas
may come as a shock to you, Bob.
Holiday trees.
But I don't consider Jesus the Messiah. And so if you're going to ask me to praise Jesus, I'm going to be a little offended. I don't think the singing of the song, that you can find other songs to sing. So what about Silent Night?
So because you're offended, none of those other kids can celebrate the great heritage of Christmas.
I'm not the one who said they couldn't do that. No, I'm not the one who said
that. See, you're a Grinch,
sir. But you're trying to force...
That's all you are.
Why are you trying to force conversions on people?
Let me ask you guys.
Yes, you are
singing
sir.
A Christmas carol.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you guys about the pressure that's been put on stores, for example. American Family Association called for the boycott of Target stores the weekend after Thanksgiving, accusing the chain of banning the phrase Merry Christmas from its stores, a charge that Target denies. Pressure from conservative groups look like it has an impact here. Complaints from the Catholic League. Walmart agreed to create a Christmas page on its website rather than a holiday page. And then Macy's, which is, you know, perhaps more closely associated with Christmas than any other retailer, sent activists a letter touting its use of Merry Christmas in ads and store windows after it was the target of a small-scale boycott last year. I mean, this is pretty amazing, all these boycotts of pressuring all these stores, these businesses, Bob.
Well, these businesses are taking millions and millions of dollars in from Christians in particular and others who celebrate Christmas, giving gifts in the name of the Christmas season, and yet they're so worried about offending people like my opponent here that they don't want to mention the word Christmas. People are sick and tired. It's the holiday time. I'm not your opponent. But
well,
I do agree with Bob.
Yeah, you are.
I do agree with Bob that I think what should happen is companies should calculate how much money they're getting from people who are celebrating Christmas and provide exactly that much amount of Merry Christmas, because that is exactly how I would want any type of religious holiday to be celebrated.
Would we be having the same argument about Hanukkah? I'm curious.
Would we have the same argument about Hanukkah?
Hanukkah is not the same as Christmas. It's not a major holiday for one thing. And this is the Christmas season.
No.
That's why billions of dollars are really being spent. It's Christmas.
Well, it's also the winter solstice
for a minute, too.
I don't know, Bob. People might argue that Hanukkah is just as big as Christmas.
Well, I would have to agree with Bob.
I would have to agree with Bob on that. And none of them says Hanukkah is as big as
Hanukkah
Christmas.
No, Hanukkah is not a high holiday. Our holidays are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which I'm sure Bob has been protesting why there aren't more Yom Kippur sales or Rosh Hashanah sales. Why shouldn't they be, right, Bob?
Well, if that was associated with that holiday, then maybe I would join you, but it never has been.
Bob, have you ever protested Martin Luther King Day not being celebrated? I mean, do you resent when people don't say Happy Martin Luther King Day a month out in advance?
You know what,
let's put this in perspective.
Bob, I want you to be able to respond, but what's interesting, the CNA USA Today Gallup poll, the question was, is it okay for people to say Merry Christmas? 88% said yes, 11% said no.
Yeah, well, 96% of Americans celebrate Christmas. So why would we care about
the
4% that get offended by it? I don't know anybody who'd be offended by someone wishing someone a Merry Christmas.
Why do we care? Why are we making all the changes, Bob? I mean, we do.
Bob, where's the war? Where are the battle lines? I mean, you can tell me that Silent Night can't be sung in one school in Wisconsin.
That's just one example. That's not the totality.
The totality is 80. You brought it up. The totality is 88% of the American population has no problem with it. You don't care about the people who don't celebrate Christmas. Fine. But I don't celebrate Christmas, and I don't care. So why are we wasting everybody's time? It's so that you can fundraise. That's why, Bob.
I think you know that's the truth.
Bob, I got to let you have the final thought, Bob.
Okay. You know, when the Nazis moved into Austria in
1936... Oh, that is offensive, Bob.
They immediately
removed Christmas
from the schools.
Hold on, Sam. Let Bob make his point.
Go ahead, Bob.
Okay. Maria Trapp wrote the story of the Trapp Singers that's in The Sound of Music. And she said she sent her kids to school after the Nazis took over, and they came home and said, Mama, we can't say the word Christmas anymore. It's now winter holiday. I think that ought to disturb people that we're moving toward that kind of attitude in this country.
The Puritans also outlawed Christmas. The founding fathers of this country would fine you in Massachusetts if you celebrated Christmas at the beginning. So don't talk about Nazis, Bob. I think that's really inappropriate. Why do you have to bring hate to this Christmas and holiday season?
Frost.
That's so sad, Bob.
Well, it's the truth. You ought to read the book yourself.
Well, Bob, it's just sad that you have to raise Nazis when you're talking about Christmas and the holiday season. And we all know that Christmas actually, Tannenbaum, it's a German holiday. Bob, I'm really, really disappointed in you.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but if you can't understand the force of history...
To bring
Who are you calling a Nazi?
We got to let it there.
I'm not.
We could probably continue.
You are, sir.
Sam Cedar.
I'm offended.
Air America Radio.
Offended.
Bob Knight, Director of Culture and Family Institute. Gentlemen, obviously, hey, it's a discussion. Everyone's talking about it, that is for sure. Or a lot of people are talking about it, I should say. Yes. Now I'm just curious, do I say Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy Hanukkah? What do you guys...
I'd like to say Merry Christmas.
Don't cut and run from the war on Christmas.
Thanks, gentlemen. Talk to you later.
Thank you.